Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Welcome to this textual study. We are so glad you were joining us today.
Yes, thank you for being here. It is it's really a privilege to unpack these teachings together.
So, to start us off, I want you to imagine just for a second trying to paint a masterpiece.
Okay.
Not just a, you know, a simple sketch.
Yeah.
A sprawling, vivid, incredibly complex landscape with a multitude of colors.
Right. An intricate work of art.
But you don't have a canvas.
Okay.
You don't have paper. You don't even have a wall. You are asked to paint this incredibly complex masterpiece directly onto the open sky.
Wow.
Just on the empty air itself.
I mean, that is an impossible task. It it defies the very mechanics of how painting works.
Right.
The medium fundamentally rejects the action.
Exactly. The tools we use, the paint, the brush, they require a surface. They require something solid to stick to. Mm-hmm. And today, we are exploring an ancient text that asks us to do exactly that, but, you know, with our minds.
Yes. It is a profound challenge.
We usually approach learning, especially spiritual or philosophical learning, mm-hmm. as an accumulation, like building a house.
Right. You lay a foundation.
You lay a foundation of basic concepts, you frame it with rules, and you gradually add the walls and the roof of advanced understanding. You gather facts. You build an identity.
Which is incredibly comforting for us.
Oh, absolutely.
We are wired to want our progress to be cumulative and measurable. We want to be able to point to our intellectual or spiritual architecture and say, you know, look at what I constructed. Look at who I have become.
But then you step into the world of profound Mahayana philosophy, specifically the teachings on ultimate reality. And suddenly that entire construction project is just, it's halted.
Completely halted.
We're looking at a landscape that is fundamentally not about building, but about dismantling.
Yes.
We aren't gathering concepts. We are being asked to let go of the very apparatus that allows us to gather anything at all.
It is a complete paradigm shift. We are dealing with an ancient text today that actively tries to short-circuit your standard operating system.
So let's establish what we are actually looking at.
Right.
The text is a canonical Mahayana Esotra for the Tibetan Buddhist canon.
Yes.
Specifically, it's found in the Dajie Kangyur. The English title is Repudiating Those Who Violate the Discipline, the Buddha's Collected Teachings.
Right.
And right up front, we really have to acknowledge the 84,000 project.
Oh, absolutely. The work they do is, it's invaluable.
They're a global nonprofit initiative, painstakingly translating the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern English. And, you know, their work is the reason we can explore this incredible document today.
The 84,000 project is doing monumental generational work. And this specific text they've translated, it's vital.
Yeah.
It might not be as universally famous in pop culture as, say, the Heart Esotra or the Diamond Esotra, but it carries this uncompromising philosophical edge.
It really does.
It cuts right to the bone of what it actually means to practice a spiritual path.
Which brings us to the core mission of our study today.
Mm-hmm.
Because this text presents a genuinely radical view of a word we all think we understand, the word discipline.
Right.
When you hear that word in a religious context, you immediately think of behavioral rules, right?
Of course. Do this, don't do that.
Exactly. Keep your vows, don't steal, don't lie. Make sure you meditate for an hour a day.
It implies a rigid set of boundaries, a behavioral checklist.
Yes, a checklist.
Yeah.
But this Esotra argues something completely different. It says that true discipline in Buddhist practice isn't just about managing your behavior.
Right.
It is fundamentally about holding the correct view of reality. Specifically, the view of shunyata, which translates to emptiness, and the profound practice of non-apprehending.
The text redefines what a transgression actually is.
Which is fascinating.
It really is. Because to violate the discipline is not merely to break a moral rule. To violate the discipline is to grasp at phenomena as if they have inherent, independent, solid existence.
Wow.
It is the very act of conceptualizing and clinging to reality that breaks the vow.
Okay, but this is where I have to push back a little, just on behalf of the listener,
mm-hmm.
because this creates an immediate glaring tension.
A paradox.
A huge paradox. Mm-hmm. If true reality, if shunyata, is genuinely beyond words, beyond concepts, beyond any distinguishing marks,
right.
How can we possibly use words to study it right now? Furthermore, how could the Buddha, a historical figure, use words and concepts to teach a reality that inherently rejects all words and concepts.
It is the ultimate philosophical trap, isn't it?
It really is.
Because if I tell you this truth cannot be spoken, I have just spoken it.
Right. You falsified your own statement.
Exactly. I falsified my own premise. And what is so brilliant about this text is that it doesn't shy away from that trap. It walks right into it.
Yeah.
The exact paradox you just articulated is the very opening of the Esotra itself.
Let's set the scene then. We are in the Deer Park in Varkasi.
A very famous location.
Yes. The Buddha, Shakyamuni, is sitting with his chief disciples. He has just emerged from his afternoon meditative seclusion, and one of his most brilliant, philosophically astute disciples, Shariputra, approaches him.
Right. Shariputra is known for his wisdom.
And Shariputra is wrestling with this exact problem we just brought up.
He is depicted as being in a state of sheer astonishment. He approaches the Buddha and essentially says, "You have perfectly explained that all conditioned phenomena are uncompounded.
Yes.
They are unarisen. They are entirely devoid of any distinguishing marks, and yet you are sitting here teaching them."
Shariputra is marveling at the impossibility of the task. He is watching the Buddha use names, use conventions and phonetic sounds to point toward a dharma, a truth that inherently rejects all names and sounds.
Right.
It is exactly like trying to paint silence by using a marching band. The tools inherently contradict the subject.
That's a great way to put it. And, you know, how does the Buddha respond?
He doesn't brush it off?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't say, "Well, Shariputra, it's just a skillful means. Don't overthink it." He validates Shariputra's astonishment entirely.
He confirms that what he is doing is impossible.
Yes. And to drive the point home, the Buddha offers a series of escalating, mind-bending analogies to prove just how absurd his teaching task truly is.
He really leans into it.
He does. He is essentially saying, "You think my teaching is astonishing? Let me give you some comparisons."
And this brings us back to our opening analogy. The Buddha starts with the sky. He tells Shariputra to imagine a highly skilled painter who can draw a multitude of colorful, complex forms, just painting a masterpiece right in the middle of the open, groundless, empty sky.
And Shariputra agrees that this would be deeply astonishing. It breaks the laws of physics.
Right.
But the Buddha counters him. He says that the fact that the Buddha can explain the Dharma after awakening to it is vastly more astonishing than painting on empty air.
Then he raises the stakes even higher.
He really does.
He says, "Imagine a person takes Mount Sumeru." Now, for those who might not know, in ancient Buddhist cosmology, Mount Sumeru isn't just a big mountain.
No, not at all.
It is the colossal, unimaginably massive axis of the entire universe. It is the king of mountains.
Right.
So the Buddha says, imagine a person places Mount Sumeru in their mouth, chews it three times, swallows it without the slightest discomfort, and then just casually walks off in midair.
It is a deliberate, almost comical shattering of scale.
It really is. It's surrealism.
Yes. And again, Shariputra says, that would be most astonishing. And the Buddha replies, the fact that the Buddha has given a Dharma teaching about phenomena being uncompounded, well, that is much more astonishing than swallowing the universe.
And the analogies just keep coming and they get wilder.
They do.
He asks, what if a deluge of water the size of the entire Ganges River was falling from the sky and someone caught the entire cosmic downpour in one single hand without spilling a drop?
Incredible imagery.
Or what if a person lifted the entire world with all its continents and oceans and climbed up to the heavens using a ladder made entirely out of the delicate legs of bees?
I love that one, the ladder of bee legs. Or what if someone hoisted Mount Sumeru with a fragile single thread dangling in the wind and just held it up in the sky?
Wow.
Or if someone took a blazing firestorm the size of an entire league, walked right into the center of it carrying a bundle of dry grass and walked out without a single blade of that grass being scorched.
Every single one of these scenarios completely defies logic, defies physics, and defies scale.
Absolutely.
And yet after every single one, the Buddha looks at Shariputra and states, the fact that the Buddha has given a Dharma teaching about all conditioned phenomena being uncompounded is vastly more astonishing than that.
Yes.
So we have to unpack the mechanism here.
Mm-hmm.
Why does the Buddha use these specific, absurdly impossible metaphors? What is the psychological goal for the practitioner listening to this?
The goal is the active dismantling of the conceptual mind. If the Buddha merely said teaching ultimate reality is very difficult, our minds would just categorize that as a standard, mundane difficulty.
Right. we put it in the same boxes, like learning quantum physics is difficult.
Exactly. We'd think we just need to study harder. But by using impossibilities, swallowing a cosmic mountain, a ladder of bee legs, he forces the listener's mind to literally short circuit.
He is breaking the machinery of logic.
Precisely. He is demonstrating that the ultimate nature of phenomena cannot be contained within the vessel of conventional thought.
You can't think your way to it.
You cannot logically puzzle your way to emptiness. To speak of the unspeakable is the ultimate miracle, because every single word you use is a compromise.
This completely upends how we usually learn.
It does.
As we were saying, we usually gather facts, we build a mental model, but the Buddha is actively destroying the listener's ability to gather anything.
Yes.
And the text goes even further into this dismantling process. The Buddha starts listing opposites and negations to describe his teachings.
This is a classic philosophical tool. It's known as the epiphatic method, or the via negativa.
The via negativa.
Right. When something is so absolute that any positive description would limit it, you can only describe it by what it is not.
So it's like a sculptor chipping away stone. Except here, there is no statue underneath. There is just the empty space where the stone used to be.
That is a perfect analogy. Mm. The Buddha says these teachings lack characteristics. They lack mental engagement. They lack effort.
Wow.
He says they are without joy, without suffering, without guidance, without a path, without truth, without falsity.
But on a path is a terrifying phrase for someone who has dedicated their entire life to a spiritual path.
It strips away all comfort. It really does. And he goes even further. He says the teachings are devoid of non-conceptual thought and devoid of discursive thought.
Okay. That specific line always trips me up. Devoid of non-conceptual thought.
Yes. It's tricky.
Because usually when people meditate, the goal is to stop the chattering, discursive thoughts. We sit on our cushion and think, if I can just make my mind blank and peaceful, that non-conceptual state is the ultimate reality.
Right. That's the common assumption.
But the text says, no, even that blank state is something you are constructing. Even that is not it.
Exactly. He is systematically cutting away every single place the mind tries to land and build a home.
Every safe harbor.
Right. If you think the ultimate reality is perfect peace, he says it lacks peace. If you think it is pure light, he says it lacks both light and darkness. He says that the Buddha does not apprehend any phenomenon whatsoever is itself what nirvut is.
Okay, does not apprehend. We really need to focus on this word because it's the fulcrum of the entire esotra.
It is the key to everything here.
But this creates a massive practical problem. If the ultimate reality is this inexpressible, ungraspable void that defies all characteristics, how on earth does a spiritual mentor actually teach a student?
A very valid question.
I mean, you still have to run a community. You still have to give meditation instructions on a Tuesday morning. If words are traps, how do you guide someone without accidentally leading them astray?
That is the exact dilemma Shariputra faces next. He essentially asks the Buddha, okay, if this is all ungraspable, how do we distinguish between a good teacher and a bad teacher?
Right.
He asks how an evil friend gives instructions versus how a virtuous friend teaches.
And this is where the Esotra throws a massive curveball to anyone familiar with standard Buddhism.
It really does.
The Buddha describes what an evil friend sounds like, and honestly, it sounds exactly like perfectly normal, standard, widely accepted meditation instruction.
It really does. It sounds like mindfulness 101.
Yeah.
The Buddha says an evil friend is a mentor who instructs a student by saying, come, engage your attention on the Buddha. Engage your attention on recollecting moral discipline. Observe the body as being the body. Engage your attention on the body's impure characteristics. Engage your attention on the fact that all formations are impermanent and are suffering.
Wait, wait, wait. Let's pause here because I genuinely need an explain it like I'm five moment for this.
Okay.
Contemplating impermanence. Observing the body to overcome attachment, meditating on the Buddha. These are the foundational building blocks of Buddhist practice.
They are.
You find these instructions in thousands of texts.
Mm-hmm.
Why on earth is a teacher who instructs a student to meditate on impermanence being labeled an evil friend who is actively harming the student?
This is the absolute crux of the text's philosophical stance, which perfectly aligns with the Madhya Emacha or middle way school of thought.
Yeah.
The problem here is not the subject of the meditation. Impermanence is a valid concept.
Right.
The problem is the verbs the evil friend uses. Listen to the phrasing. Engage your attention. Hold fast to the distinguishing marks. Bear the distinguishing marks you have observed in mind.
It's the mechanics of how they are told to meditate.
Precisely. The evil friend is teaching the student to apprehend these concepts, to grab onto them. They are teaching the student to treat impermanence not as a description of how things lack inherent existence, but as a solid, real thing to firmly hold in their mind.
So it's like trying to grab a handful of water. The harder you squeeze your fist around it, the less water you actually hold.
Yes.
And the very act of squeezing proves you fundamentally don't understand the nature of water.
That is a brilliant way to put it. The evil friend takes the medicine, the concept of impermanence, and turns it into a new disease.
Wow.
The text explicitly warns against grasping even at the most holy concepts. Even grasping at emptiness or virtue as real, solid entities is a violation of the discipline.
Because you're turning it into a thing.
Exactly. The Buddha says, when a notion of emptiness is present, notions of a self, notions of a being, will also arise.
Because if emptiness is a solid thing out there, then there must be a solid me in here observing it.
Right.
You've just recreated the ego under a holy disguise.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you reify emptiness, you have missed the point entirely. You are just holding a new, shinier concept. You are still building a house. You just painted the walls invisible.
That is a profound realization. And the text has this incredibly striking definition of what it actually means to recollect the Buddha.
Yes, this part is beautiful.
Usually people think that means visualizing the historical figure. You close your eyes and build a vivid mental image of his golden skin, his monastic robes, his peaceful face.
That's the conventional practice.
But the text says, to see the absence of entities in the absence of entities is to recollect the Buddha.
To see the absence of entities in the absence of entities. It is a profound, almost dizzying instruction.
It is.
A true virtuous friend does not teach you to build a vivid mental image to cling to. A true virtuous friend teaches you to break down the notion that phenomena have any intrinsic characteristics at all.
Right.
But, and this is the tightrope walk, they teach you to do this without engaging your attention on the very notion of breaking them down.
Okay, I have to push back here on behalf of the listener again.
Please do.
Because this is a philosophical high-wire act that feels practically impossible to apply. How does a practitioner actually sit on their cushion and do this?
It's the ultimate question.
How do you break something down without thinking about breaking it down?
Right.
The text uses a brilliant analogy here, the analogy of the tree, to try and explain the mechanics of this non-apprehending. Let's walk through that.
Yes, the tree analogy perfectly illustrates the preventative nature of this practice. The Buddha asks Shariputra, on a tree that had no roots, could it be that any branches, leaves, or bark would grow?
And Shariputra, using basic logic, says, no, blessed one, they could not.
Right, and then the Buddha applies it to the human mind, he says. Similarly, Shariputra, if one does not apprehend phenomena, could it be that a notion of phenomena would arise?
So if we don't apprehend, if we don't grab onto phenomena in the very first millisecond of perception, there is no solid thing that ever forms.
Yes.
And if there is no solid thing, there is nothing that needs to be broken down or ceased later on.
It is the ultimate preventative medicine.
Yeah.
Think about modern self-help or even toxic wellness culture. We spend so much time and energy in spiritual practice actively trying to destroy our egos.
Oh, absolutely.
Or forcefully trying to stop our negative thoughts, or violently trying to cease our bad habits. We treat our minds like a battlefield.
Like we're constantly at war with ourselves.
Exactly. But the Buddha is saying here, if you truly understand the mechanics of non-apprehending, you realize the ego and the thoughts were never solidly real to begin with.
You don't have to spend years chopping down a massive tree if you realize the tree never had roots in the first place.
Precisely.
You just recognize the absence of the roots and the whole structure vanishes on its own.
Exactly. The text states, only by not conceptualizing phenomena, not thinking about them, not negating them, not stopping them, not engaging with them and not reversing them, can it be said that one has reached the suchness that is their intrinsic nature. That is the instruction of a virtuous friend.
It requires an immense, terrifying amount of letting go.
It really does.
It is not an active, muscular suppression of the mind, which is what the evil friend teaches. The evil friend says, strive, hold fast, bear in mind.
They teach a spiritual workout routine.
Yeah, exactly. A workout routine. But the virtuous friend simply points to the groundlessness of it all. Ultimately, the Buddha says, the correct view is having no view to apprehend.
Which naturally leads us to a massive sociological question.
Right. If true practice is this incredibly subtle internal non-apprehending, what does that mean for the actual physical community of practitioners?
How do you organize around a void?
Exactly. If the ultimate truth is invisible, how do you organize a religion around it?
Mm-hmm.
Who actually makes up the spiritual community, what Buddhists call the noble sangha?
The SOOTRA redefines the sangha completely, and it is pretty uncompromising.
It really doesn't hold back.
It makes it clear that the sangha is not simply anyone who shaved their head and put on a monastic robe. The noble sangha consists exclusively of those who possess the acceptance of the absence of characteristics. It is defined entirely by an internal realization, not an external uniform.
And they don't cling to conventional designations.
Well, they don't.
The text explicitly lists these conventional labels to show how radical this is. They don't apprehend basic biological or social labels like this is a man or this is a woman.
Which is radical enough on its own.
Right. But more shockingly, they don't even apprehend advanced spiritual labels like this is a stream enterer or this is a bodhisattva.
They understand that these are merely conventional words. They are useful for navigating the illusion of the physical world, but they hold no ultimate reality.
And this is where the Buddha offers one of the most vivid and frankly entertaining illustrative stories in the text.
I know exactly the one you mean.
He wants to warn us against the danger of mistaking conventional words for ultimate truth. And he uses the analogy of the monkey.
It's a fantastic analogy.
I love this story because it is both hilarious and deeply tragic. So the Buddha says, imagine long ago there was a foolish man who lived his whole life in a barren place. He had literally never seen a monkey before.
Right.
One day, he wanders deep into a lush jungle and comes across a large troop of monkeys swinging through the canopy. Now, because he is ignorant and has an overactive imagination, he looks at these monkeys and thinks, wow, I have heard ancient tales of the glorious divine gods of the heaven of the 33. These magnificent creatures must be those exact gods.
He is completely overwrought with spiritual excitement. He is convinced he has discovered the divine.
Yes. So he runs all the way back to his town, gathers the townspeople who have also never seen these so-called gods, and he announces, learned ones, I have seen the gods of the heaven of the 33. Would you like to come and see them too?
And the townspeople, wanting a spiritual experience, eagerly follow him deep into the jungle.
They want to see the gods.
Exactly. He points proudly at the monkeys, you know, scratching themselves in the trees and exclaims, look at the gods.
And the townspeople just look at him completely baffled.
Right. And they say, alas, you fool. These are not the gods. These are just monkeys living in the forest. You are entirely wrong and mistaken. You don't know anything about monkeys, and you certainly don't know anything about the gods.
It is a tragicomic image. It paints a picture of intense enthusiasm coupled with total ignorance.
It really does. But the Buddha isn't just telling a funny fable here. He uses it to make a devastating prophecy about the future of his own spiritual community.
A very stark warning.
Yes. He says, in the future, there will be monks exactly like that deluded, foolish man in the jungle.
How so? What are the monkeys in this prophetic context?
The monkeys represent mere words, conventional vocabulary, exoteric knowledge.
Just the superficial trappings.
Exactly. The Buddha predicts that these future monks will memorize the vocabulary of the Dharma. They will learn how to speak beautifully about emptiness, impermanence, and liberation.
They'll sound perfect.
They'll sound perfectly enlightened. They will put massive effort into mastering intellectual debate tactics, which the text refers to as Lokayata teachings.
Let me jump in here just to clarify terms. Lokayata teachings essentially means worldly materialist philosophies, right?
Yes, that's correct.
It means they become obsessed with debate tactics, logic puzzles, and basically just sounding smart, rather than actually achieving any internal enlightenment.
Precisely. They master the performance of wisdom, but internally they completely lack the actual realization of emptiness. They don't understand non-apprehending at all.
And what do these performative monks do with this vocabulary?
Well, they go out to the householders, the lay people who are seeking genuine spiritual guidance, and they say, come listen to the Buddha's teachings. Come see the noble sangha.
But just like the man in the jungle, they are just showing the householders monkeys.
Exactly.
They are presenting conventional, empty words, administrative rules, and performative piety. And they are claiming that this is the divine, ultimate truth of a Buddha's awakening.
It is a profound critique of institutional corruption.
It really is.
And it is incredibly relevant today. We see this in every spiritual tradition and even in secular wellness spaces. The leaders become professionalized. They confuse the outward performance of religion with the internal essence of liberation.
Let's draw off the psychological insight here, because I think it's really important. I don't think these false monks necessarily start out as mustache-twirling villains intent on deceiving the masses.
No, usually it's much more subtle than that.
The text gives us clues about their real motivation. It says they are concerned about their own livelihood, enslaved by material things, and motivated by getting food and clothing.
That is the real tragedy of it. It starts with physical comfort.
Yeah.
They realize that sounding holy, wearing the robes well, and speaking eloquently gets them fine beds, padded pillows, and respect from the community.
Status.
Status, exactly. They get invited to the best houses for meals. So they preach the words that get them those rewards.
And crucially, they are terrified of the actual profound meaning of non-apprehending.
Oh, absolutely.
Because non-apprehending means letting go of the ego, letting go of the self that enjoys the padded pillows and the respect. Non-apprehending doesn't pay the bills. Non-apprehending doesn't build a massive wealthy monastery.
You nailed it. They confuse the performance of religion with the essence of liberation. They show the lay people monkeys and call them gods because the lay people will happily pay donations to see the gods.
Right. It is a spiritual transaction based on a mutual illusion.
Exactly.
But what happens to a community when these imposter monks, these performers, actually gain power and take over the institution? This isn't just a harmless grift. The text frames it as an absolute catastrophe.
Which brings us to the core theme of the Esso Otra's title, repudiating those who violate the discipline.
Here we go.
The Buddha details the severe consequences of this corruption, listing 10 specific torments that afflict monks who violate their discipline in this way.
And we have to remind ourselves of our mission statement here. Violating discipline in this text isn't primarily about classic moral failings like stealing or lying.
Right, those are symptoms.
Those are bad, obviously, but they're just symptoms. The root violation is fundamentally about holding on to the view of a person. It is the act of actively rejecting the teachings of emptiness while pretending to embody them.
To secretly apprehend a self, to internally grasp at reality and material wealth, while outwardly wearing the robes of a monk who is supposed to be teaching liberation from grasping, that is the ultimate violation.
It's the ultimate hypocrisy.
Yes. And the Buddha details how this hidden hypocrisy destroys the monk from the inside out, both psychologically and karmically.
Let's touch on a few of these 10 torments to understand the psychology of the hypocrite. The text says these corrupt monks dislike harmony in the Sangha.
They are deeply paranoid.
Right. They feel deep down that they deserve to be expelled. When they see truly disciplined, quiet monks, they feel incredibly inadequate and they physically leave the room.
Their internal state is just a nightmare of constant anxiety and defensiveness. They know they are frauds.
It's an internal rot.
Yes. The text describes them as violent without compassion. It says they sustain their bodies with the wealth accumulated by the hard work of others, which the Buddha calls being load bearers.
Because they carry a karmic debt.
Exactly. Because they lack true insight, they cannot karmically purify the gifts of faith given to them by earnest lay people. The food they eat literally becomes a burden.
And this psychological rot leads to the most visceral, unforgettable analogy in the entire text.
Oh, the sandalwood and the vomit?
The sandalwood and the vomit. I want to paint this picture very clearly for you because it perfectly captures the mechanics of this hypocrisy.
It is a brutal metaphor, but it is incredibly effective.
The Buddha says to Shariputra, imagine a brand new, unglazed clay pot. Now imagine someone takes this pristine pot and pours raw vomit into it.
Disgusting, but yes.
Then they empty it out. Next, they take precious, highly fragrant red sandalwood, which is incredibly valuable and smells divine, and they fill that same pot with the sandalwood. Then they pour the sandalwood out. The Buddha asks Shariputra, if you smelled that clay pot, which scent would dominate, the beautiful sandalwood or the vomit?
And Shariputra, understanding the porous nature of unglazed clay, correctly answers that because the pot was initially infused with the smell of vomit, it would only smell of vomit.
Right.
It could not possibly hold the beautiful fragrance of the sandalwood. The vile substance has seeped into the very structure of the pot.
So how does the Buddha apply this? The clay pot is the human practitioner.
Yes.
The red sandalwood represents the vows of ordination, the monastic robes, the shaved head, all the external markers of a pure and holy life.
But the vomit represents the mind. specifically a mind filled with grasping, pride, and the influence of those evil friends who teach the view of a solid self.
The Buddha is saying that a person might go through the ordination ceremony and wrap themselves in the beautiful robes. They might fill themselves with the sandalwood. But if their mind is corrupted by the view of a self and an attachment to worldly gain, their practice is fundamentally corrupted at the structural level.
They just smell of vomit.
Wow.
They lack the fragrance of discipline, the fragrance of insight, the fragrance of true liberation.
The text describes these corrupt monks in terms that are shocking in their severity. It calls them thieves of the world with its gods.
Thieves of the world.
You used another amazing metaphor, calling them stork mendicants. It refers to how a stork stands perfectly still in the water, looking incredibly peaceful and meditative, but it's only doing that so it can violently stab a fish the moment one swims by.
It is predatory stillness.
Predatory stillness. That is a devastating critique of performative mindfulness.
It really is.
But we have to ask why the Buddha is so incredibly severe here. The text makes a claim that stopped me in my tracks when I first read it.
I know exactly the line you're thinking of.
It says that a corrupt monk who transgresses the discipline in this way and consumes alms food for a single day generates more negative karma than a lay person who commits terrible crimes like stealing or murdering for 100 years.
It is a staggering, highly provocative statement.
How can a hypocritical monk who just wants a nice pillow be considered karmically worse than a century-old murderer?
I know, on the surface it sounds wildly disproportionate.
Right. I need you to unpack the mechanics of that.
It comes down to the difference between individual harm and systemic poison. A murderer harms individuals, which is horrific, and the text fully acknowledges they suffer terrible karmic consequences.
Of course.
But here is the key difference. Everyone in society knows a murderer is doing wrong. The society recognizes the evil and rejects it. The map of morality remains intact.
Right. A murderer doesn't pretend murder is the path to enlightenment.
Exactly. But a corrupt monk hides in the guise of ultimate liberation. They present themselves as the spiritual guide, the map maker.
Oh, I see.
By teaching a corrupted dharma, by teaching grasping, ego building, and materiality, while pretending it is the path to liberation, they don't just harm a single person. They cut the roots of virtue for generations of followers.
They point the compass in the wrong direction and tell everyone it's north.
Yes, they poison the well of salvation itself.
They steal the dharma. That's why they are thieves of the world.
Precisely.
They are given offerings meant to support the path out of suffering, and they consume those offerings to build their own egos, trapping everyone around them in suffering. It is an ultimate systemic betrayal of trust.
And as we mentioned earlier, the psychological toll on these imposters is immense. The text says they become empty, exhausted, and corrupted. They have to spend all their energy maintaining the facade.
Which leads to a crucial practical question for you, the listener, today. If these imposters look exactly like real monks, wear the same robes, use the same vocabulary, and sit in the same predatory stillness as the stork, how is a layperson or a student meant to discern a true teacher from a Dharma thief?
It's tough, but the Esotra gives us a very clear psychological litmus test. It is all about their reaction to the ultimate truth.
Okay.
The text notes that these corrupt monks become immediately angry, afraid, and terrified when they hear true discourses on emptiness and non-apprehending.
They feel exposed.
Exactly. Think about the mechanics of it. When a teaching systematically dismantles the ego and rejects all grasping at material reality and social status, well, those whose entire livelihood and identity depend on ego, material reality, and social status will violently reject that teaching.
It threatens their entire existence.
Right. They will react like a cornered animal. They will say, these are not the words of the Buddha. This is nihilism. This is dangerous. They will actively attack the true practitioners. Their defensive anger is their tell.
When one teaches the truth exactly as it is, this makes immature beings uncomfortable. That line from the text rings incredibly true across all aspects of life, even today.
People protect their illusions aggressively.
They really do. And this brings us to the final major movement of our textual study today, Prophecies of Decline and the Honeypot of Shunyata. Because this isn't just a critique of a few bad apples. It's a structural warning.
Having diagnosed the disease of these corrupt, grasping monks, the Buddha foresees the inevitable prognosis for the institution. He predicts that this corruption will eventually lead to the fracturing and decline of the teachings themselves.
He describes a future where Mara, who is the Buddhist personification of illusion, distraction, death, and grasping, takes the opportunity to completely divide the Sangha.
Yes.
But what's fascinating is how Mara does it. It's not through dramatic supernatural warfare or demonic possession. Mara wins through mundane, bureaucratic, institutional decay.
The banality of evil applied to a spiritual institution.
Perfectly said.
The text outlines it perfectly. It says the monks will begin to prioritize socializing. They will engage in lengthy, serious discussions about the quality of the robes they wear, the taste of the food they eat, the size of the donations they receive.
They become obsessed with the physical administration.
Yes. They will prioritize administrative duties, building projects, and material wealth over actual meditation and realization.
The text uses a specific phrase here that I want to clarify because it sounds strange to modern ears. It says these monks will develop the intelligence of women.
Right. We definitely need to contextualize that.
Now, we need to be clear that in the context of ancient Indian literature, this was a colloquial idiom. It wasn't a biological statement. It was an idiom used to describe someone who was overly concerned with domestic, trivial, or worldly matters, like managing a household or gossiping, rather than pursuing transcendent philosophical truth.
Yes, that context is essential. The philosophical point the text is making is that these monks become completely domesticated by the world. They want to rule over the Sangha. They will enforce conventions strictly to maintain their hierarchical power, but they will lack any internal realization to back it up.
And the tragic part is how they treat the next generation. The Buddha says that when young, earnest, inquisitive monks ordain, they will naturally go to these powerful elders and ask, "What are the ultimate teachings of the Buddha? How do I achieve liberation?"
And what do the elders do?
These corrupt elders will teach them the path of apprehending. They will teach them to grasp at the aggregates, to strive for attainments, to build a spiritual ego.
And then when those sharp young monks who maybe have read a little bit of the true teachings, when they question this, saying, "Wait, isn't the ultimate teaching about emptiness? Isn't it about not apprehending?" The elders will dismiss them.
They'll shut them down.
They will mock them. The true practitioners will be sidelined, suppressed, and driven away from the community because they threaten the establishment.
Which sets the stage for the final and perhaps most beautiful and terrifying analogy of our study today. It's known as the honeypot.
It is a stunning visual.
The Buddha wants to illustrate the immense, almost irrational courage required to seek the true Dharma in an age of intense institutional corruption.
Right. He says, imagine a pot of pure honey placed right in the middle of a dangerous, chaotic crossroads.
Okay.
And a proclamation is made to the world. Those who eat even a tiny quantity, as little as a hair tip's worth of this honey, will be forever free from old age and death.
It is the elixir of immortality. It grants ultimate liberation.
Exactly.
That sounds amazing. Everyone would want that. But there's a catch, right?
A massive, lethal catch. The text says that the majority of the world, including its powerful gods and rulers, would draw their weapons, surround this honeypot, and guard it aggressively.
They want to keep it from people.
They conceal it and they threaten the public, shouting, "Whoever approaches this honeypot, whoever tries to eat even a tiny quantity, will be violently killed. They are ready to slaughter anyone who comes near it."
So you have the ultimate cure for suffering, guarded by a heavily armed mob, ready to destroy anyone who tries to take it. What happens next in the analogy?
A brave person comes along, a truly heroic individual. They see the honey and they understand what it represents. They realize the honey brings ultimate liberation.
They know it's worth it.
They calculate the risk and think, if I risk my life and manage to taste even a little bit of this honey, I will not have to worry about being killed by those weapons anyway, because the honey itself grants freedom from death. So acting without any concern for their own physical safety or social standing, they sprint through the shower of weapons, taste the honey, and achieve ultimate liberation.
Let's decode the mechanics of this, because it's a profound map for the spiritual seeker today. What does the honey represent?
The honey is the teaching of shunyata. It is emptiness, the absence of distinguishing marks, the profound practice of non-apprehending. It is the ultimate truth of the Buddha's awakening that actually liberates a being from the cycle of suffering.
And the heavily armed guards, the violent mob, who are they in our real lives?
The armed guards represent Mara's forces. But as the text has painstakingly detailed, Mara doesn't usually look like a monster.
Right.
Mara manifests as those corrupt worldly monks, the institutional religious figures, and the societal pressures that suppress, mock, and attack those who try to study profound reality.
Because it threatens them.
They guard the truth and actively try to keep people away from it because teaching true emptiness threatens their worldly power, their donations, and their authority.
This is such a powerful, radical reframing of what spiritual practice actually is. I want to reflect on this for a moment because it shatters our modern preconceptions.
It absolutely does.
We often think of Buddhist practice or any mindfulness practice today as a peaceful spa retreat. You go to a quiet room, sit on a soft, expensive cushion, someone rings a gentle bell, and you find a calm oasis away from the world.
It is marketed as a soothing balm for a stressful life.
Exactly. But this text described the pursuit of true Dharma as a radical, dangerous act of rebellion.
It is an act of extreme courage. Think about it. To practice genuine non-apprehending in a world and even within a religious institution that is entirely built on apprehending, acquiring, climbing ladders, and grasping is to make yourself a massive target.
You're swimming against the current of human nature.
You are rejecting the fundamental currency of the society. You will face social exile. The text explicitly says you will not be praised. You will be disparaged by those who pursue their own livelihood.
You have to be willing to run through the spears of mockery, the spears of exclusion, and the spears of institutional condemnation, just to taste a hair's worth of the ultimate truth.
Yes.
Because that truth, the realization that the self you are desperately trying to protect from those spears doesn't inherently exist, is the only thing that actually liberates you.
That is the ultimate paradox resolved. How do you survive the weapons? You let go of the self they are aiming at.
Oh, wow.
When you stop apprehending the self, the weapons have nothing to hit. You run through the firestorm without a single blade of grass being scorched.
That is incredible. Okay, we are coming to the end of this incredibly profound exploration. Let's move into our final synthesis and figure out what we take away from all this.
If we try to summarize the core philosophy of repudiating those who violate the discipline, it really comes down to the inseparable nature of two foundational Buddhist concepts. Sila, which is discipline or ethical conduct, and prajnaya paramita, which is ultimate wisdom or insight. What the SOO Tra argues is that true discipline cannot be separated from ultimate wisdom.
They aren't two different stages of practice. They are the exact same thing. To keep the vows perfectly is to realize that there is no inherent solid self keeping the vows.
Exactly. The very moment you use your discipline to build a spiritual ego, the moment you apprehend your own purity, count your meditation hours, and look down on others who aren't as disciplined as you, you have violated the discipline at its most fundamental atomic level.
You filled the sandalwood pot with vomit.
Yes. The text forces us to realize that apprehending anything, even a concept as holy as nirvana, even the physical form of the Buddha, is a violation of the ultimate truth.
So what is the relevance to you, the listener today, whether you are a dedicated practicing Buddhist, someone exploring mindfulness, or just someone fascinated by the philosophy of mind? How do we apply this radical non-apprehending to our everyday lives?
The most practical takeaway is to deeply beware the comfort of mere words.
Mere words.
It is dangerously easy to learn the vocabulary of a discipline, whether it's Buddhism, Stoicism, or even physical fitness, without undergoing the actual painful transformation that discipline demands.
We must be hyper-vigilant against the temptation to turn spiritual practice or ethical living into a new identity. We cannot use it as a pursuit of worldly praise.
It's about radical, uncomfortable honesty with oneself. Are you genuinely seeking liberation, or are you just trying to furnish your ego with nicer, more spiritual-looking furniture?
Are you showing people monkeys and calling them gods?
And, you know, we have to have grace with ourselves, because we all do it to some extent. The human mind is an apprehending machine.
It's what it was built to do.
Exactly. The path isn't about perfectly destroying that machine in one day. The path is realizing we are doing it, catching ourselves in the act of grasping, and gently letting it go again and again. If your practice makes you feel superior, if you get angry when your spiritual status is questioned, or if you become obsessed with the outward forms and rituals, you are falling into the trap of the evil friend. You have to drop the form to find the substance.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. A meditation to carry with you as you step back into the normal pacing and chaos of your day.
Please do.
We started this study by talking about the human expectation of building an identity and the tension of using words to describe a reality that inherently rejects them. The text tells us that true awakening is simply the ultimate abandonment of all grasping.
Yes.
So I want you to genuinely consider this right now. If you were to drop every single label you use to define your spiritual or personal progress, every achievement you proudly cling to, every failure you continuously beat yourself up over, every concept of a solid self that is standing on a path moving toward a future goal, if you let all of that conceptual architecture completely collapse, what remains in that groundless open sky?
A profound question.
Thank you so much for joining us for this textual study today.
Thank you.
Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from BodhiArchive.org.